petition for review. DPI disputes that. It argues that because Evers is an elected official, his rulemaking authority is protected by the state constitution. Last year, a divided state Supreme Court ruled in favor of Evers in a similar matter, but Will President Rick Eisenberg says the split decision didn't clarify the issue.
But it seems to me that there's a need for clear direction. There wasn't clear direction, therefore, I think it makes sense for the court to take a fresh look.
DPI spokesman Tom McCarthy says the case has no merit, and the only people who don't understand it are the attorneys who work for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. NFL Monday Night Football, Atlanta beat Seattle 34-31. NBA, Bucks lose to Washington, Bulls were off. Tonight, the Bucks are off. The Bulls play the Lakers in Los Angeles. College basketball tonight, Marquette takes on number 6 Wichita State. The Badgers host the UCLA Bruins. The forecast from the National Weather Service today, partly sunny, windy, seasonal, a high of 42, winds up to 20 miles per hour. Right now, we're at 44, wind from the southwest at 14. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. We're talking about wine today on the morning show, and I'm very excited about the opportunity to speak with Richard L. Chilton, Jr., who is the author of a new book called Adventures with Old Vines, A Beginner's Guide to Being a Wine Connoisseur. Mr. Chilton has had something of a love affair with wine for many, many decades now. In fact, he traces that back to 1976 when his own parents converted an old bomb shelter into a wine cellar and thus became what has been for him an exciting and fascinating journey through the wide and wonderful world of wine, both here and around the world. He has designed this book to be a primer for those who are interested in knowing more about wine and perhaps embarking on a journey, at least in some ways, similar to his own. And he happens to be the co-owner of an award-winning vineyard, the Hourglass Vineyard in Napa Valley. And, of course, we will also take a moment, as we simply must, to talk about the devastating fires that swept through so much of wine country in California. And we'll talk about that, but mostly focus our attention on happier matters, namely the wonderful, complicated world of wines all around the world. The book again at hand, Adventures with Old Vines, A Beginner's Guide to Being a Wine Connoisseur, published by Roman and Littlefield. And Richard L. Chilton, Jr., we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg.
So expand on that story, which I just sort of briefly mentioned, namely where this all began for you back in 1976. Tell us more about what your parents did and why they did it and what a difference it made in your life.
Sure. Well, thanks. Well, 1976, we had an old bomb shelter, which if you remember back in those days, in the 60s, where everybody had to have a bomb shelter and it had to have 3 weeks of supplies. Not sure what that would have done for us, but it was decommissioned. And my dad said, what should we do with this? And I said, let's make it a wine cellar. It was dark, it was dank, and I don't, you know, I just kind of knew that's what wine cellars were like. And my dad, largely being a spirits drinker, you know, he agreed. And my brother at the time was working at a prominent wine shop in Hohokus, New Jersey, and as a driver on the weekends for spare money, and got some discounts. And so he agreed, and we set about to populate it with some wines. Now, that was pre-internet, and it was also really at the beginning stages of fine wine in the United States. And so the more I got into it, the more I realized how little I knew. And I knew that I needed to get involved with understanding about wine. And so I started to read and devour every book I could on wine, and books by Alexis Lachine and later Robert Parker, Michael Broadbent, and started to buy some wines and taste them. And as I said, the more that I realized that I got into it, the more that I didn't know. And that's the thing about wine, you know, it's a real journey. That's when I knew that it was a journey, and that the only way to really understand wine, which you could read in books, but was to pop the cork and to try wine. So I went to college and brought some of my wines with me to college in my sophomore year, and continued that when I graduated, and brought my wines to New York City, and then started to really get into it in a very big way. And of course, going in, when I would go to a city for business, I would rummage through the old wine shops and find, you know, great bargains and talk to people and taste. And so that was the start of a wonderful journey.
One of the things you say in your book at one point is that there is a distinction worth drawing between wine collectors and wine connoisseurs. How do you understand those two terms? How do you want us to understand those two terms? And which of those would you prefer that we be?
Well, I think that, in my opinion, there is a very big distinction. And it may be subtle, but it's pronounced in that wine collectors are people that want to collect a old and rare bottle. They want to buy a 1945 Mouton, which is one of the rarest and most incredible wines ever made. And they want to put it in their cellar. And they look at it and they spend a lot of money on it, and they say, wow, look at me. I'm a collector. I've got a 1945 Mouton, or I've got a 1911 Chateau Yquem. Look at my collection. Optically, isn't it wonderful? But how many of those collectors will then drink that wine? And so I make the distinction that wine connoisseurship is about buying wine and trying wine. And the whole book's premise is on wine connoisseurship, which is you have to try the great wines in the world to understand as a benchmark what wines you want to taste on an everyday basis. And so connoisseurship would never say, I've got this bottle of 45 Mouton, now I'm just going to look at it. They pop the corks and try it and say, wow, I had a 45 Mouton, or I had an old Chateau Yquem. And so a wine connoisseur would never sell wine because it got to a great price. I look at wine not necessarily what a bottle costs in the marketplace. I have bottles that I paid $50 a bottle for that are worth thousands of dollars. And I would never say, oh, there's never a time to drink that wine that's worth $2,000. I think of it in terms of what I paid for it. And therefore, I'm going to drink every bottle that I have. And that's the difference between connoisseurship and collecting. Much like, you know, car collectors who say, I've got this Ferrari that costs $3 million, but I'm never going to drive it. That's the difference.
Since we're talking for a moment about the cost of wine, this is maybe as good a moment as any to just talk for a second about a really fascinating case that I don't remember hearing about at the time, but it involves what I think you characterize as probably the single most famous example of wine fraud. It occurred back in 2012, and it involved an Indonesian man who had quite the racket going, from the way you describe it, and he ended up going to prison, sentenced to quite a lengthy prison term for what he did. I think it's interesting to talk about this for a moment just because it sort of points to a kind of a wide world out there that most of us are not even aware exists. involving incredibly expensive wine that certain people in a position to do so are willing to write very, very big checks for. Just talk for a moment about this really interesting case and sort of the context within which it occurred.
Well, yeah, the biggest, the wine fraud has existed for centuries, and you know, it was in the 80s, George DeBuff got hit for wine fraud with mislabeling Beaujolais wines. But the most famous case is Rudy Kirana, who was a Singapore wine collector, and he hit the market in a very big way, buying grape bottles and amassing what he called was the wine collection, the greatest wine collection in the world. He very smartly bought some really good wines to establish his identity and his provenance, which he then later sold at a very high-profile auction through Sotheby's. That created a credibility for him. But the real brains behind him, which was the fraud, was then to use that credibility to start mislabeling and putting fake labels on old bottles of junk, which he then sold. He got very he got very aggressive, and I remember seeing a collection through Acker Merrill that was being offered by him, which was $9 million, and a friend of mine said to me, do you want to go a third in on this? And I looked at the collection, and I just knew that there was fraud in there, because he had Jeroboams and Imperials of Mouton, 45 Mouton, which there was no way would have been made in the wine years, in the war years, because they just didn't have the capacity to make those big bottles then during the war years. And so I got very suspect about this collection. I passed. Unfortunately, a friend of mine did buy it and got stuck with it. But and the whole fraud was really exposed when he offered a collection of wines, which included a 1954, I believe it was, Ponceau, which I think it was the Clos Saint-Denis, if I remember. And it wasn't until the heir to Domaine Ponceau, Laurent Ponceau, said, this is fraud, because we didn't start making the Clos Saint-Denis until the 80s. And so, and then that's when the FBI and everybody came in. But there's a lot of wine fraud out there, and you have to be very, very careful about the provenance. So if you're going to buy fine wine through auction, you or through a store, you have to be very careful about the provenance, because you may think that a $500 bottle of wine, why would anybody do, you know, commit fraud for just $500? But it's very prevalent, and the Wine Spectator has mentioned that as much as 3% of all the very fine wine out there is exposed to wine fraud.
Scary. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Richard L. Chilton, Jr., who is the author of a book called Adventures with Old Vines, A Beginner's Guide to Being a Wine Connoisseur. That is what he has been for many decades now, and also is co-owner of an award-winning vineyard in Napa Valley. One of the things that we come away appreciating after reading your book is the international scope of great wine. And although we tend to think of great wine coming from a relatively short list of special places in the world, your book gives us a much wider global view of all of the great wine out there and all of the different places where it comes from. Places that I think most of us typically never think of as being a place where one might go to find great wine. For instance, Australia or Argentina or Hungary. Talk for a moment about kind of the international scope of the wine world and where your journey as a wine connoisseur has taken you, not only figuratively, but literally.
Sure. Well, you know, there's wine is made in so many places, and it is very international. And that's the great thing about the wine journey is it takes you into far-reaching aspects of the globe and with a lot of interesting people. A lot of people think of the fine wine business or wine business within, you know, the continental, you know, France maybe Italy and Napa Valley, but there is scope all across the world. And when you think about, and this book talks about benchmark wines, and so the profiles are benchmark wines that are the best in their varietals. So if you think about the Malbec wine in Argentina with Cantina Zapata, nobody makes a Malbec better than Cantina Zapata, and they really brought that varietal to the forefront. And it's a cross between the Cabernet Sauvignon and the Merlot grape, and it's really delicious because it has the backbone of the Cabernet but the softness of the Merlot. And they're really good at it, and there's a lot, and it's very affordable, and there's a lot of great wine that's made in Argentina or in Chile, for instance. I remember in the 80s getting involved in Chilean Cabernet Sauvignons with Concho de Toro, which was $5 at the time, Greg, and it was delicious. And I remember buying, 10 cases of it and drinking it for 20 years. What was interesting was I had some in my odds and ends bin, recently found 6 bottles left, and I served it blind to a group of connoisseurs that I had in a wine tasting. And believe it or not, after 30 years, that wine, which I bought for $5, is still drinking very, very well. So then you can go to, Penfolds, which is mostly the Shiraz grape, and or Hungary, the Tokaj, or the Rojas from Spain. But they're all included in the book. There's just so many avenues that one can enjoy. And I think that one needs to taste if they want to be a well-rounded connoisseur in wine. You can't just be narrow. You need to explore. Most people's tastes will start with Bordeaux, or they'll start in Napa Valley with the Cabernets. Maybe they'll go to the Rhones in France and then go to Burgundies. But you really need to taste all the wines of the world to be a true connoisseur.
Right. By the way, tell our listeners what happened on May 24th, 1976, in Paris, at what you call probably the most famous blind wine tasting event of all time. And more to the point, explain the way in which that really helped reshape the whole wine industry and the way the world looked at wines.
Yeah, that was the real watershed. It's called the Judgment of Paris, and Steve Spurrier, who is a British wine merchant and academician who owned the Académie de Vin, which was the wine academy in the left bank of Paris. I actually had a chance to go to his shop in the early 80s and meet him, and that's where he got in a blind tasting against the great wines of France, Bordeaux, and Burgundy. He got American wines from Napa Valley. He got the Stag's Leap wine, the red, and he got the Chateau Montelena in the white. And they were tasted blind, and they emerged as the winners. So you can imagine the chaos that existed when two upstarts from the New World were deemed to be the best up against Mouton and Lafitte and Corton Charlemagne from Lafon and Lafleuve and all the great wines of France. And that really put the new world wines in America on the map, as Robert Parker called it. It was the shot across the bow. And it gave American wines the credibility, the Napa wines credibility, to stand on their own. I talk about that because, they never would have had a chance if they were tasted in not a blind tasting, if they were an open tasting. And because so often people's opinions are formed because of pedigree and price. So you would have said, oh, this is a Mouton, or this is a Lafitte or Latour, and it costs, the equivalent today of thousands of dollars a bottle. Why would this wine have a chance? But because they were tasted blind, the true typicity came through, and the uniqueness of the wines emerged to create winners. And that's a lesson for all connoisseurs. Taste blind and enjoy, because there's a lot of interesting subtleties that come out which will shock you.
Mm-hmm. Your book tells us all about how wine is made, about different varieties of wine, and, of course, gives all kinds of advice about how best to to drink wine, to sample it, when to taste it, and so on. When you're talking about this and this question of when is a wine ready to be drunk, you tell us, first of all, that most wine lovers, you say especially American wine lovers, tend to drink their wine way too early, not meaning early in the day or early in the evening, but early in terms of that wine itself, and that we should be willing to wait a little longer. As you're talking about this, you mentioned something I've never heard of, namely that wine, after it has been bottled, can go into something you call its dumb period or dumb phase. Just briefly, can you explain what that is?
Sure. So you know, during the process, the winemaking process, you know, it goes through its fermentation and malolactic and emerges, and then it goes into the bottle. It doesn't stop fermenting, and it doesn't stop aging. And it, so there, but what it does is it goes through a little bit of a shock after it gets bottled, and it needs its fermentation to smooth, and it needs its tannins to smooth, and that takes time, but it does go through a little bit of a fusion within the bottle, and it could show quickly once it's bottled, but then it needs some time to soften. And so often most people do drink their wine way too young, and that's why if you're going to buy a case of wine, you may want to try a bottle, but leave some and then try some later on. Try some 5 years later or 10 years later. But every varietal and every year, that's the great thing about wine connoisseurship. No, it's never the same. So, for instance, I just recently bought, well, not recently, back in 2004, I bought some Clos Saint-Denis by Jadot, which is a Grand Cru in Burgundy, and from the 2002 vintage, which was a very good vintage. And I've tried one or two bottles over the years, but I just recently tried one. Now that's 15 years later, and it's still hard, and it's a wonderful wine, but it's still hard, and it's going to need some time more in the bottle. But if you were to drink it all in 2005 and 6, you wouldn't really appreciate what this wine is. And so the beauty of it is that the thicker skinned, bigger to more tannic wines, grapes like the Cabernet Sauvignon, you know, in big years, they take a long time to age. And there's nothing like drinking a wine that's aged for 10, 15, 20, 25 years to get the true typicity of what it's all about. If you were to drink a wine too young, you would never experience that.
Right. I also like what you say about wine tasting, that you shouldn't drink it all at once when you open a bottle, even in the course of that evening. Just have a little, let it sit a while, pour a little more, and just notice the difference that can happen, even in the course of an hour or two, with the same bottle of wine as it interacts with the air and so on. And you also talk about vertical versus horizontal wine tasting. Real quick, can you say what that is?
Sure. So there's really three ways to taste wine. There's the blind tasting, which I talked about. Then there's horizontal versus vertical. So if I want to do a horizontal tasting in the left bank of Bordeaux, I'm going to assemble, you know, wines within the left bank, which are going to be multiple vineyards within the left bank, and I'm going to enjoy them in the same year. So I'm going to say, okay, let's do a vertical tasting of the left bank Bordeaux wines in 2000. So I'm going to taste Léoville Las Cases. I'm going to taste Garard Larose. I'm going to taste Léoville Barton. And I'm going to enjoy those wines all in 2000. And I'm going to get an idea of how each different vineyard, how they performed in a good year. Then there's vertical tasting, which is I'm going to taste Léoville Las Cases from 1982 and 1983 and 1985 and 89 and 90 and 95 and 98 and 2000. So I'm going to taste the vertical years of one specific vineyard. and taste and see how it performed over the last 15 or 20 years. And they're two distinct ways to do it, but they're both very enjoyable. The vertical tasting takes some time to put together an assemblage of those years, but it can be really rewarding to see how the different, and you can throw in some off years in there if you want, just to see like 93 or 94. You can see how a wine stands up. And it's also really good because it gives you the ability to see the consistency of that wine producer. So I picked Leyva Las Casas because there's, even this includes some of the great first growths, there's only one vineyard in Bordeaux that has had more 100-point, according to Parker, scores in the last 25 years. The leader is Lafite, but second is Leyva Las Casas. And that's not a first growth. It's a super second, but it's very, very affordable for people. You know, it's not $1,000 a bottle. It might be $100 a bottle. And so, you know, that gives you the ability to see the consistency of each producer. And oftentimes it can yield dramatic results for the wine connoisseur.
Hmm. In our last minute or two, I would like you to say a word about the devastating fires that swept through so much of California a few weeks ago, which, among other things, decimated part of what we think of as wine country in California. You told us, told me before we went on the air, that your own Hourglass Vineyard was not directly affected by those fires. Just say a word about what was lost and what needs to happen for California's wine country to come back from such a setback.
Yeah, Greg, it was a great tragedy, and you know, my heart goes out for all the people in Napa. Profits from this book will be given to the Napa Valley Vintners Association for wine relief, and you know, over 160,000 acres were destroyed both in Napa and Sonoma counties. And big swaths of infrastructure were damaged, destroyed, and that's going to take time to rebuild. What's going to take time to rebuild also is individual vineyards that were affected by the fire. The fire burned so hot for so long that those vineyards that were directly impacted, meaning destroyed, the soils are going to take a long time to restore their nutrients to make them productive soils again. And that's something that most people really aren't focusing on. They're focusing on the vines. The vines are lost. You can replace the vines. It's going to take about 5 years for wines to get to some kind of yield, which becomes commercial, and not truly until 10, 15, 20 years. But 5 years, you can start to produce wine commercially. But it's going to take another couple of years for those soils to be restored. So you're looking at anywhere from 7 to 8 to 9 years before some of those vineyards can be fully up to speed. If you weren't directly affected by the fires and you had your grapes still on the vines, smoke inhalation on the muss or the wine grapes probably destroyed your vintage. So there's not only there's a peripheral damage as well. Fortunately for Hourglass, we had 96% of our production in, and the grapes were already being sorted in the caves, and which was helpful for us. But that effect of the inhalation from the smoke is really damaging. What was helpful for us is that it was a very, very hot summer, August, which heightened our sugar and our acidity in our grapes, which allowed us to pick earlier than some others did. So we got lucky.
Mm. Well, we appreciate you shedding some light on that, on a story that most of us don't begin to appreciate fully. And of course, your book also is such an interesting journey for anyone who undertakes it in terms of understanding the world of wine, the astonishing variety from all around the world, and your many helpful suggestions on how one can begin to enjoy wine on a whole different level. The book again is Adventures with Old Vines, A Beginner's Guide to Being a Wine Connoisseur, published by Roman and Littlefield, the author Richard L. Chilton Jr. Thank you, Mr. Chilton, for this time, and congratulations on a fascinating book.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
The time is exactly 8:40 here on WGTD. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. In the second part of today's morning show here on WGTD, we're going to be exploring the world of cigars, something which I know absolutely nothing about, but I know that I'll know a lot more once I'm done speaking with Cynthia Fuente Suarez. She is in the fourth generation of one of the world's most important families in the manufacture of cigars. Her great-grandfather, Arturo Fuente, founded the company which exists and bears his name to this very day. Over the next few minutes, we're going to be talking about what makes their cigars so distinctive, something about how cigars are put together. It's a long, laborious process. And we'll also find out about something called the Cigar Family Charitable Foundation, which reaches out to many of the rural villages in the Dominican Republic, where most of the Arturo Fuente cigars are actually manufactured. Cynthia Fuente Suarez, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am so happy to be talking to you. And we are recording this from your home down in Florida. You seem to have dodged Hurricane Irene, at least to a large extent. Is everything okay where you live?
Yes, everything is fine. We've had a number of storms in and out, and I do live on the water. But fortunately, like many that we've escaped in the past, everybody's fine, and it's traveling up the northeast.
Very good. Well, we are glad to be talking with you today. Let's begin first with a little bit about your family and its company, the brief history, if you would, of Fuente Cigars. How did this begin?
Well, when you say brief, it's hard to compact 100, beyond 100 years of cigar making. But yes, we are a family of four generations, and it stems back to my great-grandfather, Arturo Fuente, and my grandfather, Arturo, who originally came from Cuba. And my grandfather, Arturo, left Cuba in the early 1900s when he traveled to Key West, and after a few years settled in Tampa, Florida. Years back, as many people can refer to Tampa as a cigar capital of the world, brought a lot of different people from different countries who wanted to better themselves and make a better life for their families. I remember as a child growing up in the industry, we literally did grow up in the industry, but there were over 500 cigar factories located in Ybor City, which was the cigar capital of the world, as I mentioned. But my family is four generations. My grandfather, my father, Carlos Arturo Fuente, and my brother, known as Calito Fuente, and myself. Next year, in 2012, we will be celebrating our 100th year, and we have been trying to get out into the market, as we have throughout many, many years, but more so now, an appreciation of every aspect of our business, but to appreciate and to show all the consumers and the retailers for all the years that they've given to us, and we want to reach back and, you know, and continue to give them.
Very good. Your great-grandfather who started all of this, Arturo Fuente, I'm sure would be very proud. Maybe you could say a word about how many people in your family have been part of this over the generations, and a little bit about how your family works together in the family business. I mean, pretty much is everybody who is in this family tree a part of the company?
Yes, sir. It absolutely is correct in saying so. When I was young, as I mentioned, and my brother Carlos and I literally all summer long, because my grandfather's factory was in the back of his home, And there was over 500 employees, and I would say like 90% of them were family and friends. But my grandfather and my grandmother worked side by side. My mother and father will celebrate their 58th year of marriage, and my mother and father have worked side by side all along. Whereas I am one of the predominant women in the industry today, but women have played a very, very, very dominant role in the tobacco business as well. But my uncle Arthur has been involved. My cousins, my brother Carlos, and all of us have been a predominant role, because the way my father and mother were brought up by their parents, and the way my parents have raised my brother Carlos and myself, we are a very, very close family, and we work very, very well together. I feel totally blessed beyond words can even express, having the opportunity in life to work side by side by my father and brother. You mentioned how we work together. It, like they say, a perfect match in heaven. We all have our specialties and we all have our talents, but together, created as one, has been a tremendous success. Mm-hmm. And my father, who I refer to as a true genius, self-educated and taught by his uncle and father. And my brother Carlos, he's so artistic, and he's so creative, and he has created blends beyond like Fuente Fuente Opus X that is made from our farm in the Dominican Republic in the Chateau de la Fuente, and the creation of the Don Carlo, my father, coming back from 1976 in honor of him. We all have worked very well together, and we have two words that we live by, which is honor and respect. Not only on a business level, but on a personal level, that we reflect to each other. And I don't know how God put me here where he did, but I feel, like I mentioned, beyond grateful for our family heritage, for our family, and for everything that we've worked for, and that we really hope that our children and their children will continue for generations to come.
We're speaking with Cynthia Fuente Suarez, who is a vice president for Arturo Fuente Cigars, which actually next year will celebrate its 100th anniversary of existence. She is coming to Kenosha as part of a special event at Andrea's store later today, 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. They're calling it Cigar Night at Andrea's. Cynthia Fuente Suarez, as someone who has never really gone near a cigar, never even held one in my hand, and I don't think I'm probably alone in that. I don't know anything about how cigars are made, even what they consist of. I don't have any idea even what the difference is between a cigar and a cigarette, except for the size. Maybe you could just give us a little idea of the kind of the basic building blocks of the typical cigar, and then maybe a little bit about also how and where your particular cigars are made.
Oh, it would be my pleasure. Two different, complete different animals, cigarettes to cigars. Cigars are organically grown. They're 100% tobacco, handmade one by one, and it could take years and years of dedication and aging and fermenting before one smokes a cigar. Many people have enjoyed cigars, but when they're able to visit our factory in Santiago in the Dominican Republic, they are intrigued by all the different steps and all the different hands that it goes through, up to 200 hands and more before the cigar is enjoyed. It's made up of three different components. It's wrapper, it's binder, and it's filler. The wrapper is the outside layer, which is it determines a very high percentage of the flavor. And the binder holds the filler, which is the inside, and together, the binder and filler. We have wrappers from many different countries of origin, which is a wonderful thing as far as experiencing Arturo Fuente cigar, because we can take you from Africa, the African Cameroon wrapper. We can take you to Connecticut, our Connecticut shade and broadleaf wrapper. We can take you to the Dominican from our factory right in Bonao, Chateau de la Fuente, which makes the Fuente Opus X, my brother's creation. many different countries of origins, like a chef who creates a wonderful meal recipe we created in our cigars. So there's three different components, but it takes years and years for a cigar to be ready to be smoked. When from approximately you plant a seed to you take it from the plant to you put it into the tobacco barns for it to age, to cure, the tobacco to cure. Then you put it into its fermentation process, which takes years, and then aging in warehouses and aging in bundles. Then we make our cigar, and after our cigar is manufactured, it will not be left at factory. We have many cedar bolts in the Dominican Republic where the tobacco is aged, the cigars themselves, minimum from 6 to 8 months. Years and years, we have some cigars that are aged before they're released.
Wow.
Yes, it is definitely a process, and that's why that there's a lot of pride that people take. True cigar aficionados, they take pride in smoking their cigars.
Help us understand where the wide variety comes from that gives, I am assuming, a distinct difference between various kinds of cigars. What is it in these various cigars that sets them apart from each other?
Well, a properly being manufactured age, like we pride ourselves, the Fuente family prides ourselves in consistency and quality. As if you go into a restaurant, your favorite restaurant, you know that you're going to get a phenomenal meal each time. I would say like 99% of people tell me, I can depend on your product. We make a variety of different products. We manufacture our Arturo Fuente, Don Carlos, Fuente Opus X. We manufacture for the Levine family, Ashton's and VSG's, the Newman families, Diamond Crown, Cuesta Rey. And these are relationships that we've had for decades and decades. Their brands are very successful across the United States and across the world, and it's because you can never rush the hands of time. It takes a long time to make a cigar properly, like I had mentioned, through fermentation, through aging, and doing things as my great-grandfather taught my grandfather taught my father has taught my brother and I. We manufacture cigars the same way as it traditionally was done from our homeland in Cuba. We also manufacture for a Diana Gitz, a Sylvia Cigars out of Chicago, which is close to where I will be Tuesday night. And she is truly like my mentor in the industry. And on a limited basis, but we manufacture for a few different people as well.
And so for these various sort of varieties of cigars, is it that the actual taste is different?
It could be, yes, sir. Depending on the wrapper, depending where the cigar is made, cigars that are made from Honduras will have a different flavor, made from Nicaragua and so forth. But they're all a combination of blends, like a chef who's creating a recipe. Now, for an example, Cubans are 100% Cuban tobacco. Our Fuente Opus X tobacco cigar is one country of origin. So that is a distinctive taste within itself. But when you're having different countries of origin, like African Cameroon wrapper or Connecticut shade with Nicaragua or Honduras blend, each cigar is going to be different depending on the type of tobacco that is in there. And as long as it's been fermented and aged, it's a very, very predominant factor in smoking a cigar that you're going to truly enjoy. It's the aging process as well, just like wine, you know, mixing the different grapes together and aging your wine. It has a lot of similarities.
I know that one thing that your company and your family is very proud of is that many of the cigars are actually made in the Dominican Republic and are done so in such a way that those rural villagers involved in the making of these cigars earn actually a very decent wage. And, of course, we all know about plenty of companies that actually sort of prey on the rural poor. Evidently, your family has made a choice not to do that.
Yes.
Tell us about the Cigar Family Charitable Foundation, which I know you are very proud of as well.
Yes, we certainly are. We have been in joint venture with the Newman family for decades now. And in the early 2000, approximately 2001, we had a vision of improving children's lives in Bonao, which is where our Chateau de la Fuente is located. And it's a region in the Dominican Republic. Dominican is altogether very poor but rich country. Nevertheless, in that area, there's many, many poor children that never have an opportunity to have any type of future or education. So originally, we had dreams of just adding on to a local school, when in fact now we just are going to be celebrating our third graduation with children that go from preschool to 12th grade and on a 23-acre complex. And we have there, we help like five different regions of children in that area. So we have education, we have sports, we provide them with medical care, we have like a clinic there. And we have a farm that we can grow a lot of our vegetables and honey there that we can use on site. But originally we started till eighth grade. There was no place for these children to continue their education. So we added a high school. We have approximately 400 children. And the Fuente and the Newman family are very proud because the Dominican Republic has been so good to us. So we feel so proud to be part of the Dominican and to help these children. 2 years ago, on our first graduation, all of the 24 approximately that graduated continued on a higher education level, as well as last year. And what's wonderful about our foundation, the Cigar Family Charitable Foundation, that not only the Fuentes and the Newmans are a part of it, but anybody who wants to, any consumer out there, any retailer out there that wants to be a part of it can, because just for a simple $20 that, you know, we spend so fast, could clothe a child for a year with uniforms. And so there's many people that are part of our cigar family that they do fundraisers or they donate on a personal level. And we do Toast Across America with retailers. And this money goes directly to the foundation because as far as administration costs, the Newmans and the Fuentes, we take care of all the administration. So any money that's donated goes directly to these children. They're forever, forever grateful. And they've been taught English. They've been taught French. And, of course, predominantly Spanish. So it's a bright future that they have, and they want to. Many of them, they graduate, and they go back to help on the complex themselves so that they can continuously give back as we feel that we want to give back to that country that's been so good to us.
Very well put. Again,
yes,
that is
the... We've also done water wells. You know, because the water is contaminated in those areas. And like the Rotary Club and many clubs in Tampa has helped donate their time as well to try to make that area, you know, as best that it can be.
Cynthia Fuentes Suarez is a member of one of the world's leading cigar manufacturing families. She came to Kenosha several years ago at the invitation of Jack Andrea when that venerable store celebrated its centennial. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Margot Kahn, who is the co-editor of a wonderful book called This Is the Place, Women Writers Writing About Home. It's 30 different essays, each about home. And the various facets by which one might think of home. Sometimes a place of stability and safety and comfort. Sometimes a place that can be a source of some of life's most painful difficulties. It's a fascinating book, a fascinating collection, and we talk with its editor on tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You can find the morning